recommendations that it has are fairly aggressive and would probably be pretty expensive to implement, but they're all very good ideas.
A similar proposal to control what people on food stamps buy made it through the state assembly 2 years ago, but never became law. The bill would have required two-thirds of food purchases to be healthy. Grocers said it would be expensive to implement. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
10 past 8, let's check WGTD sports and weather just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg. The NBA, the Bucks beat Memphis 121-103. Bulls had the night off. Tonight, the Bucks are off, and the Bulls host the LA Clippers. In the NHL, the Blackhawks off last night. They're off again tonight. Now the WGTD Tuesday forecast from the National Weather Service. Partly sunny, maybe some scattered flurries, a high of 37. Now 27 Racine, 25 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Jack Andrea. For over 100 years, Jack's has been celebrating spring with the finest in Easter treats, from their famous pecan jelly beans to solid milk and dark chocolate bunnies. Let them assemble the perfect Easter baskets for your loved ones. JackAndrea.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This is the unmistakable music of Carl Orff from his dramatic cantata Carmina Burana, one of the great masterworks of the 20th century, and a work that is going to be presented this weekend by the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin, along with the Studio of Classical Dance Arts. And that recording certainly brings back happy memories for me as one of the soloists for these performances by the Choral Arts Society. That was the Choral Arts Society you were hearing. And Carmina Burana in a arrangement of two pianos and percussion accompanying the adult choir and children's choir in what was a really, really memorable moment in the long, rich history of the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin. They are going back to Carmina Burana this weekend, and this will be a different performance, a different kind of performance, because it will incorporate a very vivid and brilliant presence of dance to enhance what's already an incredibly rich and exciting piece. So I'm excited to have with me today Jim Schatzman, with the Choral Arts Society, of course, who's been with us before, and Linda Bennett, who is one of the artistic directors of the Studio of Classical Dance Arts. And she's been on the program as well with her husband. They co-direct the Classical Dance Arts, and that group always does a marvelous performance of Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker each and every December. And actually on the stage where this performance of Carmina Burana will take place, the main stage at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Jim Schatzman, when did you get the idea, first of all, of returning to Carmina Burana and then returning to it with this twist?
It's one of those iconic works. It gets in your blood. You have a chance to conduct it a few times, and you're constantly reminded of the piece by hearing the music in commercials and movies and everywhere else. So it's really become a part of our culture, and it's one of those pieces that just you just burn to conduct. It feeds you to such a degree that you must do it again. And so this is the Choral Arts' third presentation of Carmina Burana, and we're very, very excited to be bringing dancers into this work in a way that Orff intended it to be done, but it's just not often done this way.
I did not know that. Tell me more about Mr. Orff's intentions.
Orff really thought about this work as a feast for the senses. Not only his kind of passion for percussion and passion for children making music, but also as a visual feast. That this was a spectacle that was being brought forth, and a spectacle that, in a sense, in the 20th century, that reached people at their emotional core. And so seeing dance, hearing drumming, and hearing tunes that are in some ways less complicated than what was going on. This was not music by Ernst Krennic or Xenakis, you know, an academic exercise in mathematics. This was really a stripping down of going back to beautiful melodies and powerful harmonies that just grab you at your emotional level. There's an immediacy to this music that he was working for, and it was a brilliant success. And even now, in music where there's been kind of a neo-romantic movement back towards more harmony and melody, Orff is really the person, I think, who started that movement in the 30s. And as he said, once this work is written, he said, throw everything else out. This is where my corpus begins.
Right.
And so this piece has an immediacy, even for conductors. You never get tired of this piece.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot there. It's a rich, complicated score, and we'll talk about it in just a moment and talk about the intriguing texts that are part of it as well. So Linda Bennett, I assume that this idea came from Jim for some of your dancers to be part of this. How did you and your husband greet this invitation and this possibility?
Good morning. Yes, it did come from Jim. It was a wonderful, actually, email a couple days after he and his grandson had come to see our Nutcracker. And he had emailed us and said, hey, we've got to do a collaboration. And one of the first things that he brought to the table and that just made perfect sense to Mark and I was Carmina, because it's full of everything. It's got the choral, it's got the children, it's a ballet in and of itself. So it was just a wonderful idea that we said, let's roll with.
So it sounds like you're already answering a question, which was my next question, which was this a work that you were familiar with? And also, were you familiar with it in terms of it being something to which you might dance?
Sure. Actually, Mark and I actually have a connection to the music, because we performed the ballet as a ballet when we were dancing with the Milwaukee Ballet Company. Actually, back in our first season, in the 89-90 season, we presented Carl Orff's Carmina Burana, which was choreographed by a very famous choreographer named John Butler. And so we performed it. And so we were definitely familiar with the music, definitely familiar with the idea that it was a ballet, and had the real privilege, actually, of being able to meet and work with John Butler himself when we did it. He passed away just a couple years later, so we feel very lucky to have experienced the choreographer himself.
Wow. So a bit of history there. So what is involved in choreographing something like this? Because unlike Nutcracker, I don't think the story of Carmina Burana is a story. I mean, there's no chronological arc of a story. There's no characters, I don't think. So how does it work to choreograph something like this? What are you bouncing off of in order to come up with what the dance will be?
A lot of reading. A lot of reading the text, a lot of reading the lyrics, and listening to the music over and over again, and really just kind of diving into what the lyrics are actually saying, and then trying to bring that out through the dancers. And it's been really fun. It's been a lot of work, but it's been really fun and challenging, because we're asking our dancers to move in ways that are much different than what you'd see in the Nutcracker. The movement is much more contemporary. I mean, there's parts where they're rolling around on the floor, and there's parts where they're standing up and doing classical steps.
Wow. Jim, talk for a moment about the rich array of texts. That's part of what makes this work so absolutely fascinating. Explain where the texts come from and at least in brief, what they are about.
These texts were discovered as margin notes and poems that were written by monks, not about things monks usually write about. It really delves into, in some ways, the emotional life of somebody who's kind of been trapped or sequestered into a manner of life that one could argue monastic life is not the most natural thing in the world, These monks obviously knew the world. They were out there. There are songs about drinking and singing the glories of drinking, which you wouldn't necessarily expect from monks. There is a overlay of the world being somewhat harsh. That you're kind of subjected to the fates. And the opening movement is basically talking about, you know, life is hard, and sometimes life will just roll you over, and you're just subject to a life that's tough, that's capricious. It's very unchristian. It's not that kind of idea, but more of a kind of a worldly idea that life is tough. Sometimes you're on the top, sometimes you're on the bottom. Sometimes you got to work your way back up. And then the secondary theme within this, the architecture of the way this is presented, is around the ideas of young love. And it must have been a very fertile area for a monk who probably never experienced first love to have to imagine what it would be like. And some of these poems are very beautiful. Some of them are a little racy. You know, you talked about characters earlier. There are spots in this where there are obvious characters that when you just sing it in a concert performance are not there. There's the movement Stati Puella, which just basically talks about a young woman, says she stood like a stately rose. So Linda has choreographed this beautifully for a young lady in a red dress while the soloist sings this bass and does a solo number. And so we have this. There's a movement that talks about young ladies saying to the shopkeeper, "Please give me some rouge for my cheeks. I want the boys to notice me." Very fun kind of lyrics. There's a lyric that says, "If a boy and a girl tarry in a room too long, who knows what's going to happen?" You know. So there's some kind of tongue-in-cheek stuff as well. Part of the architecture of the beginning of the story goes from this big movement that you just heard, that fate can be a tough challenge. And it uses the metaphors of life going from winter to spring. And so you kind of imagine the second movement, this quiet forest with very little happening. The dancers are moving very slowly. as if they're moving in the winter movement, and suddenly that little more as each movement kind of comes more to life and more to life, till it says the forest is bursting all over with life, mm-hmm. and the dancers are flying all over the stage. It's really very dramatic.
Wow. There is the presence of a children's chorus, and I know that there's another movement we're going to sample in just a moment. Explain to our listeners who might not be aware of Carl Orff's connection to the world of children and to the business of children making music.
Carl Orff, I think this is a product of a little bit of who he was. Orff was somewhat self-taught, and most authors can say you can, although he had some formal training, really allude to the fact that he learned music in his home. His mother was a fine pianist. They spent time together. By the time he was a very young man, he had already known most of the duet literature. They'd done symphony reductions. He knew a lot of literature by the time he was really forming in his teen years, and so his exposure was pretty strong. And he learned some of the modern techniques of music and started composing that way. But he also always had a real fascination with making music, not just composing music, but making music. And he had a very simple premise, is that children were natural music makers. And if you facilitated that in even just a modest way, they would take off. Children naturally love to dance. They move. And what goes better with movement than drumming? And so Orff developed an entire educational system around drumming and instruments the size that children could manage, small little bells that they could manage, and drums that they could hold under their arms, and that they could move with as well. So there's this whole idea of the integration of dance, of movement making, of drumming, and of singing. And so even in followed through to the Carmina Burana, the tunes that you hear in Carmina Burana are not complex like Bach. Mm-hmm. You don't have a lot of counterpoint. They're very straightforward. They come right at you, much like in a gentle side, like a folk song, a beautiful folk song you hear with just a guitar and a single singer, a melody that's maybe somewhat predictable, but very linear, very, very sweet. And even the big stuff is pretty... It's direct.
Right. It's not very vivid.
It's not complicated.
Right. And repetitious in the best sense of the word, too.
Yes.
I mean, you have a very bold idea, and he gives it to you sort of again. And I love that, because a lot of modern scores are exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. You feel like you're just lost in a swirl of notes. And Carmina Burana, it's like you always know, in a sense, mm-hmm. where you are. And it's so exciting. So explain the movement that we're going to listen to just a little bit of, that involves children's scores.
Tempo Signor Cundum is one of the largest movements in the whole piece. It involves everybody. So the children's chorus, the baritone soloist, the soprano soloist, and this is one of the heights of the movements where, you know, love is in the air. Everything is just wonderful. People are having a wonderful time together. And life is good. This is one of those kind of pinnacle movements, mm-hmm. where you're at the top of the wheel of fortune. Everything's wonderful. There's the crowning glory of the forest is there, and we're just all ready to make music.
So here it is, another moment from Carl Orff's Carmina Burana.
Here, 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 here
Wonderful memories being evoked here of Carl Orff's Carmina Burana. The last time the Choral Arts Society did the work, which was how many years ago?
Oh, my goodness.
Long
I think the first
ago.
Time we did it was 2003, and the second time we probably did it was about 2007.
Ancient history, but happy history. So it's going to be performed twice this weekend on the main stage of the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Have you had a chance to be on that stage yet, or have your rehearsals happened someplace else?
Not yet, but we're close.
Right. Linda Bennett, I know that your husband, Mark, who is your partner in crime with the Studio of Classical Dance Arts, is at Parkside today, readying some of what needs to be in place.
Yes.
So describe visually what people are going to see at these performances of Carmina Burana.
Sure. Well, visually, the stage itself is not going to be the focus in terms of the backdrops and things like that. It's actually going to be fairly spare and sparse. And so the focus is going to be on the chorus, the children, and the dancers. And that's where things are really going to come to life. Lighting is going to be really interesting and different. And what will happen throughout the ballet, throughout the dancing, is as the dancers change costume, as the music changes, as we go from winter and cold and kind of dire to spring, and you kind of feel the sun coming up and everything's warming and the flowers are starting to bloom, the colors will come out more in the dancers' costuming and in the movements that they do. And then as we come around the corner and we finally come through summer, kind of the way we think about it is summer and into fall, things get a little darker, a little richer in terms of the colors and things, and then we come back to where we started, which is fate will always bring us back to the same place.
Funny how that goes. You mentioned that this is very different dancing for a lot of your dancers compared to, for instance, what they do in the Nutcracker. I should think this has probably been a very rich learning experience for them in that respect.
Absolutely. I think it's just been wonderful for them to not only expand their dancing in terms of what they're doing, but also just such a wonderful experience to be able to perform with live music and musicians and a choir. I mean, most dancers don't get that opportunity, maybe even their whole careers, to have something like this, especially with everybody on stage. I mean, that's when it's done as a ballet, it's not usually done with all of the choir on stage. And we've got 66 choir members on stage with the dancers for the whole thing. And I think that in and of itself is exciting. And having those voices come from behind the dancers and just push that energy out into the audience is going to be amazing.
Wow. And I remember, Jim, from these performances that I was especially impressed with how well the choir counted. And I remember when you commissioned me to write a Gloria, and I wrote Shepherd's Gloria. One of the reasons it has all these wild time signature changes was because I saw how well your group could count even complex rhythms. And that's got to be one of the richest challenges and most satisfying challenges about doing a piece like this, I should think.
It really is. This piece has a unique energy to it that just kind of grabs you. It really does. And it's the rhythm and the bold and clear and straightforward harmonies that are in this piece. And I think Orff was right. If you present these rhythms as something that are kind of earthy and can kind of come from within, people tend to grab onto them. I don't talk about them as complicated to the choir. I talk about them as organic and natural. And so maybe they don't think it's as hard as it really is. I'm not sure what the deal is, but they do. They have a very strong sense of rhythm, and they move very well together in that rhythmic structure.
Right. And it seems to me that in the same way that it is valuable to have a choir sing Bach chorales, just for the sake of the discipline and for all the ways you grow just from doing it. Seems like Carl Orff's Carmina Burana is a similar piece that can just make a group better if they are up to the challenge.
Absolutely. And just the way that Carl Orff shapes his melodies too really teaches you. My early mentor said, if you want people to sing wonderful melodies, teach them to sing plain chant. And that's a lot of these early pieces in Carmina Burana are set in kind of this plain song structure where you have to have a sense of where this phrase is going, or they're very static and boring.
Right.
And so getting these folks to realize that the phrase has an architecture and a direction, and how do you sense that architecture? Once they grab that, they feel it. And it really is an emotional experience if
Fantastic.
You can grab onto it.
Right. So these performances occur this weekend, Saturday at 7 p.m., Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m. on the main stage at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Jim, if people are interested in getting tickets, what do they do?
They can go to our website at choralartsonline.org, or they can call our office at 634-3250, and we're pretty sure that tickets will also be available at the door.
It's a big hall, so lots of seats, but this is a rare treat that should not be missed, and especially the way in which this is a collaboration between the Choral Arts Society and the Studio of Classical Dance Arts. What an exciting idea. It's great to hear that it's going so well, and we hope all goes well from here on. Jim Schatzman with the Choral Arts Society and Linda Bennett with the Studio of Classical Dance Arts, we wish you and everybody who's a part of Carmina Burana exciting and wonderful performances this weekend. And thanks for being part of the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you very much.
Part two coming up in just a moment here on WGTD. Carl Orff's Carmina Burana. The time is 8:36. You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Here is part two. We're spending this portion of WGTD's Morning Show with a woman by the name of Anna Sabino, who is actually the designer behind a highly regarded jewelry brand called Lucid New York. And Anna Sabino made the decision to, in a sense, leave a nice, solid life on Wall Street to embark on a more creative venture with her own jewelry collection. And she has done very, very well. But rather than just sit on her own success, she is really anxious to help others experience similar success in their own lives with their own creative ventures. So she is a certified career coach and has written a really interesting book called Your Creative Career, Turn Your Passion into a Fulfilling and Financially Rewarding Lifestyle, in which she shares some of her experiences with this new venture for her and offers some very practical suggestions for anybody who would like to launch something similar. And I'm excited to be able to speak with Anna Sabino about her very interesting story and very interesting book. Anna Sabino, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg.
I've sketched out just the barest minimum of your own life story, which is really so interesting. So let's give you a chance to describe it in a little more detail. Explain to our listeners what you were doing professionally and then what you decided to do quite differently then.
Sure. So I was on Wall Street and had a job as a market analyst, which basically involved sitting at a desk for 10 hours a day, not too much interaction with customers, etc. So I felt pretty limited. I felt that my growth, my professional growth, had like a box around it that I couldn't really be in charge of my career, my future. So I started working on making a transition. I really felt this hunger of starting something on my own, on living on my own terms, and being in charge of my time. So it took a while to get it off the ground, and I chose a safe approach because I think entrepreneurship in itself is pretty risky. So instead of just quitting my Wall Street job and cushy paycheck, I decided to start my creative career and still be on Wall Street for about a year until my jewelry brand Lucid New York took off.
And of course, it has been a very, very exciting success with maybe one or two bumps along the way. But generally speaking, it has done very, very well. So as we explore your book and what you have to say to people, one of the most important things to talk about is this matter of creativity and the fact that, in your words, we are all creative. So, but a lot of people don't tend to think of themselves as creative and tend to think that a creative venture like yours is something they couldn't possibly even think about doing. What is your notion of creativity, and how do you want people to think about their own creativity?
So I do think that we are all creatives, and we tap into our creativity daily. Even, deciding about our next career move, our next task, and approaching all that creatively. Because we are not all the same. So we don't, for example, approach a transition or a change in the same way. And we don't even approach success the same. Although society is trying to condition us or pressure us into thinking of success in financial terms. But for some of us, it may be having more time to spend with our family or traveling or creating a location-independent lifestyle. So creativity comes into play as far as approaching our future steps, decision we make daily. It's all tapping into our resources, our creativity, our creative self.
So you suggest that really everybody needs to sort of ask themselves what they want to do with their life. And in many cases, it will be something more creative than maybe they are doing at the moment. And this is an important possibility to at least consider. In the course of doing that, one of your bits of advice is that people should stretch their walls. What do you mean by that? What is the importance of stretching your walls, and what are you saying there?
Yeah, Greg. So I think in our careers and lives, we tend to just keep repeating and doing the same thing over and over because it's just comfortable and we don't feel the push or the pressure. But taking a step back and stretching ourselves a bit, doing different things, taking on different projects, even if they don't seem to be comfortable at first, can be really good for our self-discovery, for our career, because we may discover what we like doing, what we don't like doing, what gives us true joy. But by doing, repeating our routines and just, sometimes we say we just go with the flow. But no, instead of going with the flow, taking a charge of our flow and choosing things that we can engage in, choosing new things, approaching new people, scheduling new coffee talks with people we've never met, reaching out can be extremely beneficial to our lifestyle design.
One of the things that you take a little time to talk about is that to do what, for instance, you did in terms of launching your own jewelry line, one of the things that you had to do was you had to be willing to accept the discomfort of being at zero. That is starting from nothing. And I think you're absolutely right when you say that when people talk about this, especially when people who are quite successful look back at the beginning and they will talk about, yeah, I started this from scratch, but they kind of breeze over the reality of what that really feels like to begin with, in a sense, not much of any money in the bank and no successes to build upon. I mean, it can be a very, very daunting situation. And I think you're telling people you need to be prepared for what that feels like to start from the ground up, starting at zero.
Yes, and it can be extremely lonely because not many people understand us, especially those with 9-to-5 jobs and steady paychecks who are not at zero, who don't have to build anything from scratch. And the most challenging, I think, in this stage that we all go through, not once, but multiple times in entrepreneurship, is that we don't know when that stage is going to end. It's not guaranteed that we have an end in mind, that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, that after, let's say, a month or a year, you know, we will succeed. We don't see it. We don't know it. So we are basically putting all this energy and effort, tremendous amount of time into something that we don't know the result of. And it's usually unpaid. So for those who transition from traditional jobs, it can be very challenging if they're used to getting paid for results right away, steady paychecks, weekly paychecks. But that's the price that we pay to truly build something that we want, to step into the career path that we've always wanted. It's not easy. It has roadblocks. It can be discouraging because nobody likes zero readers, zero followers, zero customers, but this is definitely a part of the process. Hmm.
We're speaking with Anna Sabino about her book, Your Creative Career, Turn Your Passion into a Fulfilling and Financially Rewarding Lifestyle. Much of the book includes very practical advice, in part because, as you tell us, it isn't just about whether or not you are creatively talented, but whether or not you have the skills and the determination to do something with it. You write at one point, "We've always put talent on a pedestal, but it's actually its application that matters. Our perseverance and commitment to our goals is more important than our talent." And I suppose if somebody sort of blunders into this kind of a venture thinking that just their sheer talent and creativity will be enough, they are likely to fail rather miserably.
Yes, I see it often that very talented people create pieces and then they don't know what to do with them. And the danger here is that they often think that the making process stops at creating. But nowadays, we all have to be involved after. After we created something, it's about distribution, about selling, marketing, personal branding, etc. And there are no excuses anymore. We can't say it's not for me, I'm not cut for business, I'm not cut for marketing. It's the space, the entrepreneurial space is just too competitive. The barriers of entry are very low. Everybody can start a business. So it's we all have to be involved in all the steps of making it. It's not just creating and then waiting what's going to happen. Of course, you can get lucky, but in a lot of cases, you may just wait and wait and wait. So to take it into your hands, I would strongly suggest that you devote your energy into creating and at the same time into marketing and spreading the word about what you're offering.
I really appreciated some of your thoughts on avoiding creative block. And I know in some of the ventures in my own life that this has sometimes been an issue, or it's been hard for me to write or hard for me to compose music for one reason or another. You speak especially interestingly about this in a section titled Woman with Her Back to the Ocean View, in which you suggest that someone doing this should think about the space or the place in which they are doing their creative work, and maybe think about different kinds of spaces. How has this worked for you, and what suggestions do you have for people in terms of thinking about where geographically they should do this creative work?
Well, it's an exploration, definitely, because it's very personal. I personally have to be in movement. I do a lot of work on my phone. I have to change locations. But a lot of creatives, I think, make space in their homes or studios, and they almost force themselves to create things only there, because their desk is pristine, everything is ready, and they are ready to write. And sometimes it may not happen because this may not be an environment for them. I know that for some, ambient noise works really well, so that's why we see so many creatives in coffee shops. And being in movement or taking exercise breaks, it is very, very beneficial to the creative flow. But I would say if we feel not inspired in this space, even though it's our home, let's change it. Let's change it because it hasn't been working. And what I noticed for me, I try not to focus on just 3 to 4 hours blocks of time, but I try to utilize even 15 to 20 minutes, even when I'm waiting in line or if I'm at a parking lot, and just tap into my creativity. If it starts flowing, why wait? These 20 minutes can be way more precious than 3 hours that we blocked for creating, just because we feel inspired and inspiration is precious. I grab it whenever I can.
You also have a interesting idea about how somebody who is engaged in this kind of creative venture might be really tempted to follow their own passion, which sounds really good, but can be sometimes quite impractical. If your passion is leading you to paint paintings or create pottery or write songs that nobody wants to purchase. And so you are, I think, suggesting or reminding us that you need to have some kind of a balance between your own passion and gaining a sense of what the world is interested in purchasing from you. What are your suggestions on keeping these two matters in balance? Two matters which might in some ways seem kind of diametrically opposed to each other.
Yeah, Greg. So let's assume here that we are talking about creative careers. We are not talking about creative hobbies, because if you have a hobby, you could do whatever you want. But if I believe that if you want to start a business, a sustainable business, where you charge, you're able to to pay your bills with, you have to come up with a system, with a strategy. You have to keep your customers in mind, because ultimately they're going to be paying for your work. So it's not just about you and what you like and your family and friends, but it's total strangers who are going to be supporting your business by buying your pieces. So I believe that testing as early as you can and getting feedback, and that can be sometimes harsh, but if we transform the critiques into the feedback and distill the best out of it and just build upon it to create something that people want and want to pay for it, we set ourselves up for success. And I think engaging our customers in the early stages of creating is very important. I don't think creating in creating in solitude for a long time and then revealing, surprising. I don't think customers really do want to be surprised that much. They'd rather have a product that will solve their problems. They'd rather have a say in our creating. They want to have it customized. The surprise matters less than we think it does.
You also have some advice that I wanted to be sure to ask you about, because this was one of the biggest things in the book that had not really dawned on me until I read your book. And that comes down to the matter of timing. And you say that in many cases, creative people or people interested in launching a creative venture are sometimes really obsessed with the notion of being first, of being really early, ahead of the curve, which, of course, in at least certain cases, can be very, very advantageous. But more often than not, lunging at something early, prematurely, can lead to the downfall of a venture. What is your advice in terms of timing and this notion of being early versus being right?
So often it's our ego. We want to be inventors. We want to be looked up at. But I think striving to be first and rejecting ideas just because they've been done before is a risky strategy, because we can't. Let's put it that way. It's really risky if we're not. It's not risky for celebrities, for example, because they can, you know, start or invent anything they want. But to start from something from scratch is just, we don't know how it's going to be received. But let's say we are the second one in a row, then we can kind of ride the wave of the popular products that are already there. And there is nothing wrong with being second, third, fourth, with building upon the idea. Not all of us have to invent. Inventing is challenging in this world where it seems that everything has been invented. So what I say and what I truly believe in is it's not about the idea, it's about its execution. So if we are second or third, but if we actually execute better than the first person, we can actually be way more successful than the inventor.
I want to finish by having you talk about the importance of disavowing ourselves of the myth of the overnight genius. This myth is certainly pervasive in our culture, and I think you feel like this is really counterproductive when we let ourselves get caught up in this myth. Where did this myth come from, and why do we need to try to disengage ourselves from such a myth?
Yeah, so the media, social media, definitely feeds that dissatisfaction. We look at others and we see their followers, likes, popularity, platform, and we just think that everything just showed up to them like that. But we didn't see the struggle. We didn't see the tears and months or years of posting content or working towards some unknown goal. And I think just minding our own creative path and staying where we are and truly enjoying the process can be something that we should make ourselves aware of if we want to succeed in the creative field, because it can be extremely destructive to our own creative career, to our own life, to focus on the dissatisfaction, because there's always going to be somebody who started earlier, who has more resources. So all these excuses are stopping so many of us from starting businesses, writing books, and we don't see these things because of the insecurity of not being enough. So I would like to just conclude this thought saying we are enough. We have enough. We have everything that can take us to start what we want to start.
The book again is Your Creative Career, Turn Your Passion into a Fulfilling and Financially Rewarding Lifestyle. The book is published by Career Press, and you can find out even more information about Anna Sabino at her website, annasabino.com. Anna Sabino, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. I enjoyed our conversation, and I enjoyed your book.
Thank you, Greg. It was a pleasure.